Welcome to the Gorfine, Schiller, and Garden podcast series. Today is part two of a two-part podcast series where Chuck Fonts, Director of Business Valuation and Litigation Support at Gorfine, Schiller, and Garden, is speaking with Jeff Sands, the Managing Principal of Dorset Partners, LLC. Jeff is a corporate turnaround specialist who has won multiple awards from the Turnaround Management Association. And for this episode, Jeff and Chuck will run through various turnaround scenarios, the salvation process, friendly foreclosures, and much more. So yeah, we've talked a lot about turnarounds, preserving value in a business, but how about let's talk about some real life examples, and I'll kick that one over to Chuck.
Sure. I have a client that transitioned a business from first generation to second generation, but now the second generation has a turnaround that they are dealing with. It's a high volume restaurant. In fact, I think at one point it was the highest volume restaurant in the country. It's got very high name recognition and it's tourist destination, family owned, as I said, second generation. But the second generation that's active in management spends most of its time on another larger and more valuable business. And it's interesting that this other larger, more valuable business bought the name from the high volume restaurant because they saw the value in the name recognition and they paid the restaurant business over, it was a 5-year period. And for that 5-year period, the revenues that were recognized related to the sale of the brand, if you will, papered over the fact that the restaurant itself was losing money. I mean, it turns out it's got way more capacity than it can hope to fill. The real estate is leased at a way below market rate, and the real estate got a higher and better use than as a restaurant. It used to make lots of money, but over the past several years, and this goes back to the categories of things that cause problems for companies, the restaurant has not been able to adapt to changes in the market. And so now for the past several years, it's been losing money. So, you know, the second generation realized where a big chunk of the value was, took that and applied it to a business that had more ability to scale. But the flip side of that is that they let the smaller business, they kind of left it bleeding on the table.
Yeah. And was it primarily just that the ownership's attention shifted and they forgot about the restaurant and stopped paying attention?
No,
is that the main reason
point.
For decline, you think?
It was a big part of it, actually, was because while the first generation was still alive, the second generation didn't want to make too many changes because of the pride of authorship or the first generation created from nothing, from very humble beginnings, created this very well-known brand. And it goes back to that last 50% of psychology. Rational thought processes would have led them down a completely different road, but it wasn't rational. It had to do with essentially not wanting to hurt the feelings of the first generation founders of the company.
Right. So done properly, they would have started up the manufacturing, kind of shift the brand and some of the IP, and then probably could have sold the business at that point, which plenty of people have done. They've spun off a restaurant and into food production, or brought in a manager to focus on the restaurant or do something else. But you're right. And I grew up in a family business, and I get all the emotion that's wrapped up. Sentimentality is what somebody once told me. And there is just an incredible amount of sentimentality in the family business. And I made lots of mistakes because I was incredibly sentimental about our family business. You know, it was like a sibling. So I get it. But now if, you know, it's neglected and they're finally realizing it, then I think your options are, you know, a quick fix, a quick sale, or a quick close. If it's burning cash, you know, if it's burning cash, it's got to be quick. If it's not burning cash, you've got time to take your time and figure out your options. But probably comes down to those three options, fix, sell, or close.
And it's unfortunately burning cash, and they don't still at this point have, to my knowledge, a plan to rectify that situation. I mean, the good news is the food production business, which you correctly described, makes plenty of money, and the second generation has been willing to subsidize the restaurant business from the losses in the restaurant business from the food production business. But you know, for the life of me, other than the sentimentality, which is exactly what's going on here, other than the sentimentality, there's no rational reason to continue operating the restaurant. Everything's sellable at a price, but I don't know whether it would be sellable at a price above the liquidation value because of the way that it's structured. I mean, just its physical size. So, you know, that remains to be seen. But it's a challenge, certainly for the family, to figure out the least costly way to get out of that situation.
Yeah. And because it's a family, they want to do it gracefully and fairly and justly. And, you know, whereas an outside investor, it'd be pretty easy to make that decision. The beauty and the liability of family-owned businesses, it's a lot more than numbers.
Right, exactly.
Nice. Chuck, you want to share about another example about when to take on debt?
Sure. So this is another example. This one actually has, at least at this point, looks like it's going to have a happier ending, but it's not without risk. This is another food flavoring manufacturer, actually. Again, family-owned. This one has been consistently profitable, growing at a stable rate. And historically, it's had very low leverage, and they, in the recent past, have turned down pretty lucrative offers to sell the whole company because they want to keep it in the family. So again, this notion of sentimentality, it's more than the numbers. But now the two founders are getting older, and one in particular is ready to retire and is ready to be bought out. And at this point, it looks like a significant chunk of debt is going to be used to fund that buyout. And so the debt as a component in the capital structure is going to go from less than 10% to something probably significantly north of 30% of the total invested capital of the company. And the good news is they're doing it very analytically. They want to make sure that they'll be able to service the debt given reasonable expectations about what may happen to the business going forward, not just having rosy assumptions, but also understanding that there's a business cycle to deal with. But yeah, it's going to go from, as you said, having virtually no debt to having a significant amount of debt, which leaves the remaining owners, if things go along as they currently are, there's still going to be a significant amount of equity value. But to go back to your point that you made in the first part of this podcast, you know, if multiples go down and cash flows go down, you know, the value may go to the point where, you know, there's enough to pay off the debt, but then there's nothing left for the equity interests to receive. So that's a definite concern.
Yeah, I was in one a couple years ago. When I got there, they were in trouble. The bank was calling the loan, you know, out of cash, all the normal problems. And I said, okay, well, what happened here? And the owner had two partners. One had left, let's say, 6 years ago at a high reasonable valuation because the company was doing well. And then the second partner left about a year ago at the same high valuation, even though the company had turned unprofitable. And I said, well, I get why the first guy was paid on that valuation. Why was the second guy paid on that valuation? And the remaining owner, the third guy's response was, well, it's what we all wanted. And I thought if the second guy got out with a lot of money, maybe I could get out with a lot of money. And of course, all he got out was a lot of debt. And the first two owners, his two partners, so maybe going back to your situation, beyond the debt, you're also taking out a critical person who may or may not be, you know, a rainmaker or significant player in that business. And perhaps they can't be replaced by an employee. So this guy, my example, the partner in charge of sales quit, then the partner who understood everything with a number, you know, so all counting the whole front of the business, retired, and the guy who was left understood manufacturing, but nothing else. He didn't understand sales, didn't understand accounting or finance, and now he had all kinds of debt piled up, and it dragged him down. And so, yeah, I get what you're saying, Chuck. You know, they turn, and that can be a big anchor, you know, especially we're at the end of a growth period, probably by definition. I would also question the talent that's walking out the door, the talent, the passion, the conviction that partner has, which sometimes you got to hire three people and you still don't replace what that owner had. Sometimes you can replace them with half a person. But you're right, it's dicey, and to be taking on debt and exposing yourself to bank credit is a scary thing. And once, I don't want to get too deep in this, but, you know, there's an entire universe in bank workout and how they deal with credits and everything else. And the biggest thing to remember there is that somebody in workout is the biggest pain in the butt and not listening. And somebody is the best student and paying attention to everything and, you know, getting up early and drinking raw eggs and going for a jog and getting themselves back in shape. And it's that the bottom guys in workout are in a constant state of being liquidated, and the best ones with the best attitude and the best work ethic and sort of, you know, dialed in, paying attention, they get released back. You know, they get sort of released from the hospital and go back to normal life. And so even ending up in the same situation, again, you get back to psychology. Psychology is what gets entrepreneurs out of tough spots as much as anything they can possibly teach in business school.
Yeah, great insights there. And, you know, earlier, gentlemen, we talked about baby boomer entrepreneurs. And I'd like to dive a little bit deeper on that, because I know Jeff has a couple of points to make on this front. And with Jeff, I'll hand that over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Getting out, there's a couple ways to get out of a business. Obviously, you know, selling for a premium is a wonderful thing. I remember a company near me several years ago, they were building bridges and big steel fabrication. They were getting wiped out by foreign competition, the exchange rate, all these issues. And the owner said, you know what? Partner retired a couple years ago. Business isn't profitable, but we've got a strong enough balance sheet. I'm just going to wind it up, which I thought was ludicrous, but market conditions were such that I didn't feel like buying it and trying to take that risk. And he just had a peaceful liquidation, sold off everything, paid the employees, paid all the vendors, paid every bill 100%, had a couple hundred grand left in his pocket, and went to play golf and play with his grandkids. So it's a happy ending. It's what I call a peaceful liquidation, because you don't have the bank hitting you in the head during this process. When things are really on fire, and we talked about this a little bit, like giving CPR to a business, I've come up with this term, the salvation process. And the best way to picture it is, you think of, like, you know, archery, where you're shooting an arrow at a target with rings, stack four targets in a row. What you're really going to do is shoot for the top one. And as long as your aim's good, maybe you don't have the strength and maybe your arrow falls short. But the theory is that even if your arrow falls short, it's going to hit at least the bottom target and you're going to hit something. So if you stack up, even in the nastiest situations possible, where you can't make payroll, there's lawsuits everywhere, there's legal issues, IRS, EPA, people quitting, on and on and on, you can do CPR, hold an emergency, and generally runs like this. You take about 2 weeks and you cycle through the customers, you put on your greatest charm offensive and see if you can book orders and rebuild your backlog. If you have a backlog, then you can go figure out how to finance it. You know, a backlog's a business. Without a backlog, you don't have a business. If that's not working within 2 weeks, then you go to an emergency sale process where you're working up a teaser and your database and your offering memorandums sort of in the background while you're doing step one. Now you're trying to get your customers, you're trying to also lure them back with potential strategic buyers and get them excited. If that's not working, then you go out to other, you know, you go beyond your strategic buyers, you go to distress specialists, you go to anybody who might possibly buy the business. Step below that would be a friendly foreclosure, where we go to the bank and say, hey, we've done A, B, and C, they're not working. These are good entrepreneurs. They want to do the right thing, but the bank's going to take a loss, and here's our options. We can either get really nasty and fight each other, and the bank takes a big, ugly loss, or we can all get along, be friends, be peaceful, act like adults. The bank will take less of a loss, but you've got to let our guy off his personal guarantee. You've got to promise the entrepreneur a release now to get his compliance over the next couple months as we go through the auction process. And it works. And so, you know, I didn't do this with my own turnaround, but I've gotten to the point where the worst case situation possible is we can move past it professionally. The entrepreneur gets released from his creditors. We get a free start on life, but we didn't go through a bankruptcy process. We stayed out of court. We didn't fund attorneys and Mercedes dealers. And the entrepreneur gets to move on and do the next thing in his life. The bank gets to move on, and people aren't stuck fighting over the scraps of the business. So, you know, I've gone through this enough that I think there's always a clean cycle out. I think there's always options, and there's always a way to do it, minimizing the pain on the entrepreneur. But again, you know, as we've been saying throughout this conversation, it gets back to psychology. If the entrepreneur is bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and saying all the right things to the bank, they'll get support. If they're doing the opposite, they won't get support, and it does become a very painful exercise, which, you know, is ultimately why I do it. If I can save entrepreneurs from getting creamed and save a community and save the jobs, there's no greater feeling in the universe that I've ever found.
All right, perfect. Well, this has been a wonderful two-part podcast series that we have recorded, and I think we could probably end up doing a 10-part podcast series, because there's just so much to cover off on this topic, and it's truly fascinating. And so with that in mind, I'll ask this to both you gentlemen. Anything else to add today? And I'll go to Chuck first.
Well, I think we've covered the waterfront. It's interesting, though, how often the word psychology has come up.
Yep.
Yeah, I think we covered it well and hit the most important parts. And I appreciate y'all's time today.
Perfect. Yes, I appreciate it as well.
This is a wrap for our second interview in this two-part podcast series about valuation and distressed businesses. To learn more, please visit the Gorfein, Schiller & Garden website at gsg-cpa.com. And to learn more about Jeff and his services, please visit dorsetpartners.com. And thank you for listening today.